simply cheer this piece of trying to imagine.
It's on the projector input now.
What's that? It's an open office.
The problem might be that the scan converter wasn't plugged in the projector.
Oh.
Let's just give yours a try again. Because that's me.
Heya. Sorry to start a little bit late. Apparently the projector works better when it's plugged in. So this is Mark Shuttleworth. He's a PKI guy because he did something involving 40. Then he was a space guy because he did something involving going into space. And now he's a canonical guy and he's going to talk about Ubuntu.
And Ubuntu. So let me just see if I can get this up here. So just out of curiosity, how many space fans do we have in the audience? How many of you guys... Okay, and that was just absolutely the one thing I wanted to do as a career. Then various other things came along, and I found myself getting sucked into the internet and public key cryptography and whatnot. And when the dust settled, I find myself sitting on a beach in Cape Town wondering what on earth one does next. So I made the terrible mistake of asking myself the question, have been to Russia or speak a little bit of Russian? Okay, a couple. So you know, it is the most extraordinary place. It's kind of like it's like Steve Jobs' paradise, a reality distortion field. Covers basically everything from I nearly said the Vatican, but the Kremlin out to Star City. I find myself negotiating with a space agency over there about how they get into space. So I figured out I needed to do something that would make the Russian Space Agency and the Cosmonaut Training Agency and Energia and all the guys who make and service the Russian space infrastructure take me seriously. And someone suggested that the one thing that I could do that would raise, you know, that would get everyone's attention would be to go through the cosmonaut medical testing, physical endurance tests, metabolic tests, and so on. Anyway, that all went fairly well. I'm going to slow this down a little bit. That all went fairly well. And I then found myself sort of certified to start cosmonaut training. And that's all done at an amazing place called GCTC, the Yuri Gagarin Center for Cosmonaut Training, which is in Star City. It's probably going to make it a bit more manageable. Thanks. So basically, Star City is this military base. It used to be totally closed. There are sort of layers and layers of faith. There are now about 5,000 people living there, most of whom actually have nothing to do with the space program because the space program has contracted so much. About 1,000 people are focused on the training of the cosmonauts and the design and certification of new space vehicles. At Star City, you'll basically learn everything there is to know about spaceflight, so the space station itself, because half of the space station was built by the Russians, and so they have all of the simulators and training equipment for you over there. This is sea survival training. The Soyuz is actually designed as a capsule that comes down under a parachute, like the old Apollo and Mercury capsules. But the Russians land in the desert, sort of like a car accident crash landing in the middle of the desert. So what they do is they take you out with this specially modified Soyuz down to the Black Sea, usually, to a place called Sochi. And then they have this big military barge, and they dump this Soyuz on the military barge, and you practice basically emergency evacuation from the Soyuz into the ocean around you. It's actually the most dangerous still survivor day in the water, at least that's the theory. So you get pretty heat exhausted by the time you get out of there, and they've had to send a couple of cosmonauts off to hospital. It was calm on that day, so they say, no problem, we put divers in to make waves. And then they make the thing do this. So not only have you got serious heat exhaustion in Sochi, but they don't have budget to rent a car on the other side, so they stick a minibus inside the cargo plane, and fly you down. So you've got a minibus, two Soyuz vehicles, and a whole bunch of drunk Russians, because Sochi is like the party capital of Russia. So all the guys try and time their leave for around about the time that the plane is going down. It's just of taking this massive old Ilyushin 76, flying it up to 7,000 meters, and then pointing its nose up in the sky and flying these huge parabolas. So you get sort of 25 to 30 seconds of zero G. Boris is not particularly strong, but when you're sort of floating around, it was easy for him to sort of wave me around like that. And over time, you can imagine there's a fair amount of wear and tear. The astronauts were a little surprised when they got told to show up at the military airbase on the day that they were going down. And they were even more surprised when they got told to climb into the cargo plane, then into the minibus, and put their seatbelts on. So another interior of a Soyuz capsule inside the bubble over here, it's huge. It can take two people side by side, and it can push up to 30 Gs. You can't do 30 Gs, but they use 30 Gs for testing equipment for some of the more extreme conditions that might happen during flight. As a cosmonaut, you have to pass a testing regime of 8 Gs for 30 seconds, parts of the body, and tries to keep as much of the blood in the upper body as possible. It's kind of incredible to see how you get tunnel vision as the G-forces kick in, because the blood is getting pulled away from the frontal part of your brain where vision is processed. And they actually measure that by having this set of lights an arc of light in front of you. So you're strapped into the seat, and you've got how bad the tunnel vision has got.
Welcome to Kazakhstan. Well, this is very cool. So, this is even better. This is the vomit throne, basically.
You're going to get sick in space, right? You're going to get space motion sickness, which is like seasickness, only worse. And there's no telling how long you're going to get it every 3 months and be able to last 10 minutes, which is no fun. Once your body decides it's going to go. I actually heard the woman say something in Russian the first time they put me in that. Like literally a second before I realized I was going to throw up, she said something in Russian. The guy afterwards said, she'd said, got him. Because they've got all your vital statistics. You're all wired up. So kind of angle and position, either deflated or inflated. And so it tends to cut the blood flow off from behind your knees, and you end up with really sore legs. You have to be able to do 2 hours, basically, in an inflated suit. So they keep tweaking the suit, and you keep sort of training how to survive like that until you can do 2 hours with the suit inflated. And then they stick you in. It's got nothing to do with testing the suit, and that it's purely a kind of a psychological training thing for the cosmonaut, because when you get on board your spaceship, you do realize that if there is a depressurization, you've been through it for 2 hours, right? You've actually been in a vacuum, and you know your suit is good. And it's very comforting to know that you've kind of been through that. It's not that comforting when you're sort of sitting there and they're strapping you in and then mad when the day comes and it's time to get out of there. Yeah, Martin.
Did you know Russian before you started this project, or did you have to learn that at this time as well?
No, I had to learn Russian. That was the hardest thing, basically, was to learn Russian on a hangover. Like brain surgery without anesthesia. So there are so many right-hand tire of the bus going to the vehicle purely because Yuri Gagarin did it. The amazing thing is you arrive here at the base of the rocket, and there are about 300 people all sort of arrayed there. It's, you know, all of the guys. It's actually much more dangerous. I mean, liquid propellant is much more dangerous than solid propellant in, you know, pre-ignition, because all it takes is two leaks and a spark, and you're in sort of tricky territory. The really scary bags, and it emerged, you know, we started talking, and they asked if I was here for the launch. I said, yes, I was. And they said, oh, well, maybe we'll see you tomorrow. So I said, what do you mean? So they said, no, we're the guys that actually fuel the rocket. So, you emergency escape system, that little pointy bit at the top of the rocket is a solid fuel booster, which will pull your capsule away from the rocket if the whole thing sort of goes pear-shaped, at least in theory. And a couple of years ago, they were going through the processes and had a small mishap when they armed SUS. So SUS starts as disarmed, and then at some stage during the ground sort of finalization processes, they arm it. And a kilometer. Anyway, so you're sitting there, and the amazing thing is you have very little, I mean, really nothing to do until you get to the launch point. You don't drive the rocket. Basically, you're a dead lump. You're a brick on top of a rocket. And it's everybody else's job, basically, to put that brick into a precision orbit. The launch itself, they've started wearing nappies. They didn't have them for us, but the shuttle guys have like an absorbent sponge thing. And apparently they've started doing that for the Soyuz guys since our flight as well. I don't know why. Maybe someone didn't, you know, manage with the tire. So it's 8.5 minutes to orbit, and it is the most incredible 8.5 minutes you can imagine. It's actually less incredible forces on your body, and this voice telling you, you know, everything's looking good, yep, telling you altitude, telling you your velocity. It's kind of incredible as your velocity creeps up. You know, you break the speed barrier pretty quickly, and then it goes Mach 1, Mach 2, Mach 3. By the time you exit the atmosphere, you're up well over Mach 3, and then you really kick in, because with no resistance from the atmosphere, you accelerate. It's just amazingly well engineered, right? There's nothing in there that doesn't need to be there. It's perfectly designed to get three guys up into low Earth orbit to dock with the vehicle and bring them back safely. The lower chunk over there is the propulsion modules. The central chunk, kind of the dome shape, that is actually the re-entry capsule. So that's where you are for launch and landing. It happens in stages, and at any stage you have to be, you know, have an abort and return to Earth process. It's all done automatically, but you have to be willing to take over and go manually. During our docking, we actually nearly took over, literally 3 seconds before docking, we drifted off course. And there's a cone about a meter 20 wide that your probe is in space and has everything that you need. That's where the sleeping compartments, the toilet, the oxygen generator, atmosphere scrubbers are. That's the dining room table and the kettle. The kettle takes about 3 days of full-time study just to have a clue sort of vaguely what's happening. It's extraordinary. It basically takes your... takes the perspiration. Living together, you sort of get to know that you're going to share everything anyway, so what the hell. The two pictures up there that are really... There's Tsiolkovsky was the sort of father of Russian rocketry, and then Yuri Gagarin, they kind of sense in the cosmonaut program. This is the Aurora Australis. Because we were flying in April, in fact, the... show up very well in the photograph. This is the U.S. lab module, so it's designed to manage experiments. Most of it is just rack space, basically. There is one sort of sleeping compartment in the back right corner over there. Dan Birch, one of the NASA guys who was on station exercising in the background there. And I'm just getting a... They have some Solaris boxes, which they use for monitoring the status of some experiments. Most of those are kind of buried around in the U.S. lab. In one stage, I came floating into the Solaris box, and one of the NASA guys was sitting there basically reading boot time error messages over a really bad space-to-ground link. So it was really nice just to sort of nudge over him and tell him it got used as the test models. Based on that, the NASA guys said they would never work. And then based on that, they sent up the identical models now for the crew. That is a long-range shot of Cape Town taken at night. Now, I could never have taken that shot. It took him about 6 weeks to get the shot. Because Cape Town is about 30 kilometers across, and you're moving nearly 8 kilometers a second. So, and your exposure, because it's a night shot of the city lights, the exposure has to be about 8 seconds. So in that time, you're gonna traverse, basically, the city would traverse from inside your field of vision to right outside your field of vision. You have to track it. So to take and had the drill bit attached to that, and he figured out, depending on exactly what speed of rotation he set for the drill, he could basically get the camera to track the Earth. So he basically designed a spy satellite system in space. It's amazing what you do when you're up there for 7 months and you're really, really bored on a Saturday night. The node, which is one of the connecting modules between the Russian FGB, the sort of storage compartment, and the lab that you saw earlier. That's one of the laptops and the coax cable. They actually have a 2 meg S-band connection that's very on and off at the moment because the station isn't fully built, and when you don't, you have nothing. So the cool thing is one of the astronauts went up and quietly installed Cisco voice over IP software on the laptop, completely illegally and unbeknownst to ground control. And the ground controllers were astonished to notice that, you know, suddenly the whole mood on the station seemed to change. Everybody was much happier. They couldn't understand what was going on until they realized that they were just phoning his crew. Roberto on the left is up again. And then the three guys upstairs were on station when we visited. So this is your ride home. It's quite a daunting thing. You've had 10 days up there, and you're just kind of settling in. It's nice up there. That whole zero-G thing is incredible. It's amazing how the body gets used to it. It feels totally normal to have some... I lost my toothbrush behind my head so many times. So you kind of had these 10 amazing days, and it's then time to come home. And it's kind of daunting because at that stage we hadn't had Columbia, but the Russian tragedies had all been during re-entry. And you know that this is going to be really the roughest portion of the flight itself. This is just the top of the atmosphere. So it's designed just so that you will catch the top of the atmosphere. You don't want to hit the atmosphere too hard. You don't want to miss it. So you just want to catch the top of it. And then you wait. And it's kind of a weird sort of time because you've got 25 minutes to sit. There's nothing you can do, right? You've used more fuel than it would take to speed you up again. So you are going to hit the atmosphere. And the Soyuz turns itself upside down. So basically those three pieces together. and heavy-duty compressed springs, which are trying to push them apart. So when the pyro bolts go, the three pieces sort of shoot apart. And the idea is that the habitation module sort of is pushed down at sort of some steady speed so that it's going to get caught by the atmosphere first, and then you'll get sucked in, and then the engine didn't. So he actually came in tumbling like this until the cables burnt through and separated that way. You then go through the sort of the really rough part of re-entry. The temperature, you actually watch the temperature building up, and you see the outside of your vehicle start to burn up. All that fabric burns, and then all the wires underneath that start to burn away. You actually get molten, and you get up to 5.5-6 G's on a normal re-entry, 9 G's if you go ballistic. We had a very standard re-entry. We landed within 2 kilometers or something of our nominal target site. Once you're through the G-forces, the other thing that happens is these rocket thrusters start shooting outside your window to rotate the soil and kind of rattling and creaking as you go. It's just an incredible experience. Once you're through the deceleration, and you're basically free-falling, you're a 3-ton block of metal free-falling towards the Earth, you on the one hand, you're relieved that you made it through the sort of pressure cooker stage, but on the other hand, you're now waiting for your parachutes to deploy of the Soyuz. So you can imagine if you've got something moving 250 seconds, and then you 2 meters per second, and then you pull a set of chutes out of the side of it, it just whips around. It's the most incredibly violent experience to be going at sort of at that huge pace, spinning around, and then suddenly have the Soyuz shake you up like that. I just remember Roberto saying, "You have no idea where you are." I mean, by the way, you know, the technology is early 70s era technology, so there's very little in the way of guidance and positioning. You don't actually know where you are. You could be way off course, so you're totally dependent on the search and rescue services at this stage to sort of try and find you. The helicopters usually spot the chute because it's very brightly colored, so the commander has to have this panel in his hand, and it has the command set off a set of explosive bolts that will basically cut you free of the parachute. Now, you really don't want to hit that before you actually hit the ground. But you really want to have it handy so that you are able to hit it if you need to. You know, the guys who flew after us were coming the parachute. But our landing was perfectly nominal. We actually landed and stayed upright, which happens very rarely. And you know, I can't describe the feeling for you of sort of sitting there and looking out the window and seeing grass just outside your window, because for the last 10 days, you know, it's just been this sterile environment. Seeing these sort of kids had come over on horseback to try and spot the spaceship. So that's about it. Any questions? Yeah.
That 2 meter hook that you had to use, that was iffy. What you had, what was it like to do
it? Geez. I can't tell you exactly, but it actually felt pretty good. The one thing with the voiceover,